Yeah, I said if you did that, you'd be doing physiology.
So that's the part that gives him the whole cycle.
Yeah, that's the psychological part.
Is that, okay, did he come at it at, I'm trying to get the sense he had for what kind of an explanation this was.
It was causal and it was physiological, and those were two more or less givens, that that's what you had to have. In 1900, scientific explanation had to be causal, and scientific explanations of behavior had to be physiological.
Was he using the psychological stuff as being explanative, or was it something there, or?
This was theoretical. It wasn't already there, as far as he's concerned. When we think of this, we can say, yeah, it was already there, because one makes those kinds of distinctions even before psychoanalysis. Aristotle was making the same distinctions 2,000 years ago, and people were making the same distinctions, no doubt, 2,000 years before Aristotle. So it isn't as though Freud invented these things as relevant to behavior. But from his point of view, you see, if behavior simply is the visible performance, then something was needed to explain why you perform visibly in the way you do. And these are capable of doing that, as we saw over here. But this is psychology. And at that time, psychology wasn't enough. You had to ground it in physiology. So if we take Freud as the observer and everybody as actor and us as critics, we say, some of what Freud does is clearly responsive to the necessities of the subject matter, but other things that Freud does are about as clearly responsive to the social milieu, the time in which he lived. And had he been living today, he probably wouldn't talk the way he did. He'd be talking information theory or something else. But at that time, one had to talk this way, in this general way, in order to be a respectable psychological scientist. And given that constraint, in addition to the constraints of the subject matter, between the two of them, we can account for Freud's theory. If we didn't have that historical background, there are various things of which we would say, why the hell would he say that? Why would he talk that way when it's so easy to talk some other way? And indeed it is, but it wasn't for him then. And 30 years from now, people will be saying the same thing about us. Why were these guys talking about behavior modern information processing when so clearly there are other superior ways of talking? I say, yeah, well, it's easy for them, but not for us. This is what we have. So there are historical constraints on theorists, no less than subject matter constraints. Okay, any further questions now from last time? By the way, before I forget, read these four chapters, read them in that order, and study this one especially, and figure that we will cover at least these two. This one will be more or less optional.
You just got over somewhere, but I still don't understand that. So you can have to place it. And why it isn't necessary
to have a psychic object. No, it's not necessary that the psychic object be of any particular sort, so long as it is displaceable.
I understand that part, but I understand how that's so inefficient as far as random selection. You have to have something in mind when you can choose a
thing. Well, that's why I say that it's tempting. In the way that the theory is phrased, one is strongly tempted to say, just what you said and say, but how does the body know how to produce the right kind of object? You have to look at it cross-eyed three times before you really see that it, nothing of the sort is really needed.
Can you repeat that part then?
Yeah, that if you look at the principle of displacement, it says that if you have an actual object that the individual does interact with and does so successfully, i.e. it satisfies the aim, then this object will be displaced in that direction. Now that's all that needs to happen. Now in order for that to happen, this one does not need to resemble this in any way. It simply doesn't. Therefore, formally, it doesn't matter what this is, so long as it can be displaced in a gratifying way, or so long as the individual can interact with this in a gratifying way, this will be displaced. And the more it's displaced, the less it matters what it was to begin with. And the pattern is exactly like the Darwinian evolution, random mutation and natural selection. So it's a familiar and coherent form of explanation. This can be random so long as the selection is non-random. The net result will be very non-random.
So how would you base the selection?
The survival of the fittest.
But then each time it would be a matter of random choice and that is correct.
No, because remember, this is displaced and the next time the source is activated, the object comes to mind is more like a real one. Yeah. Because remember how long the infant stays an infant. See, there is a lot of time for a lot of very primitive learning to take place. You can say, well, it isn't very efficient and it would take a long time to pay off. But indeed it does. And you might say, from an evolutionary point of view, it's more efficient to have this fandom because nobody can predict over millions of years what the nature of these will be. And so any biasing in the direction of these at a given time will be a biasing against the objects which may be there years later. You can see that there are some strong internal resemblances between this theory and the Darwinian theory of evolution. A very simple idea here.
This actually provides for cultural evolution, because if the parents change before...
It doesn't provide for it, but it allows for it. There is nothing in the theory that would enable you to state explicitly that anything of that sort occurs. Given the kind of statements that you can make in the theory, there's nothing to prevent it from occurring. See, there's the difference between a theory that doesn't deny certain things versus a theory that would enable you to assert those things.
Well, when you bring in the parent, the child becoming like a parent, that allows, can you say then that allows for it? Or what provides for sameness?
No, not yet, because that just provides for conservation. If the child is just going to become like the parents, there's no principle of change there.
So you have to provide them a principle for change in the parent?
No, the principle for change comes in the objects, the non-parent objects, or in the incidental characteristics of the parents. That not all parents are alike. And that corresponds to over here in this sequence. Remember I said, in the light of different circumstances, it will take different customs to implement the same theory. Well, likewise, when it comes to identifying with parents, if parents are different from one time to another, when it comes to effective commerce with objects, if the objects are different from one time to the next, or from one generation to the next, there will be change in what the child learns, what he learns to do. But notice this isn't, these are not now theoretical statements. These are just open possibilities that the theory leaves room for. It doesn't say that anything of this sort will happen. And one reason it doesn't is that nothing of the sort has to happen. There doesn't have to be change over time. You bet you bet your life on it, but it doesn't have to be. So a theory like this then will allow room for that, but will not say that in fact it will occur. And that preserves its non-empirical character. Because the question of whether change will or will not occur isn't empirical. Okay, I think we're about ready to move into the developmental aspects of the theory. In this case, I think it comes off easier if, rather than presenting the developmental theory separately first, we simply start with the developmental schema and assimilate the developmental theory to it. Recall that here we have a three-way link. There's prior capacity plus intervening history gives you a given set of ID characteristics. I recall I said in talking about this formula that there's nothing in the formula that says that you have any particular time interval, that you could use the formula across any time interval, about across any set of time intervals. And that the main practical limit was the time interval over which you could establish any difference in ID characteristics. Therefore, something on the order of 1 second probably would not be efficient. Now, in this case, in psychoanalytic theory, there are some time periods that are labeled as psychosexual stages. And these have the same logic as this, namely, these characteristics that you acquire here, plus what happens in between, produce the characteristics that you have here. These characteristics plus what happens in between leads to these characteristics, and so on down the line. These three are marked by the fact that they, for Freud, they represent sources. And you remember I said a source is a place in the body. And these definitely refer to distinctive places in the body. Furthermore, they represent places where it makes sense to talk about locus of gratification. So you have something that fits this kind of notion. That there definitely are places, there are places that it makes sense to talk about gratification or non-gratification, therefore of increase or decrease of tension. Independently of this sort of notion, you have social behaviors involving feeding, toilet training, and I'm not sure what you would call this. You call it control of masturbation or something like that. That these are visible social issues in the socialization of the child. And they do indeed revolve around here, here, and here. Now, because of this, you have an interesting setup in psychoanalytic theory where you can talk about things in either a biological way or a social way, behavioral way. And very often it's not clear which way he's talking. And as a matter of fact, as you schematize this thing, it's reasonably clear that he begins talking in a way that looks very physiological and winds up talking in a way that looks very behavioral. And that too is part of the historical thing that if you have to ground psychology in behavior, it's nice to have a system that starts out having only biological characteristics and yet is one from which you can derive social and behavioral characteristics. And as critics, I want to pose the question to you whether Freud really succeeded in doing that, or whether there wasn't some sleight of hand here. The sleight of hand will stem from the fact that you can talk about these things in either way, and it's not clear from the way you talk which way you're talking. Okay, we'll come back to that later. Consider the oral stage. It revolves around feeding. And imagine the range of things that can happen, the kinds of effects it can have on a child, an infant. And specifically, the ways that things can go wrong here. What's it like if it goes right? Well, the child learns to feed in the way that he's provided with. He does it enough, but not too much and not too little. He does it when it's offered and not when it's not. And he succeeds in getting the food down and stays healthy. So that's kind of the normal baseline. Yeah.
Along with each one of these stages, you could also say that associated with each of these locuses or sources are certain kinds of psychic doctrines in the instinctual brain. In terms of the neural stage, you'll be associated with more oral. Right?
Mm-hmm. Except, as you saw, we don't know what the nature of that object is. You can say formally that with the different sources you would expect different objects, but since we said it doesn't matter what the original one is, they might as well be the same. It doesn't make any difference. Okay, think of what can go wrong up here. How could it go wrong? Well, the most obvious one is that your child doesn't get fed. He doesn't get it when he needs it or wants it. So he's frustrated, he's deprived. Or he gets it, but it's painful. So he gets what he wants, but he didn't want it to be that way, and so he pays a heavy price.
Or he wants an inappropriate
time. From his point of view, there's nothing wrong with that.
That's true.
But one way of having it be painful is if he gets too much.
Yeah.
Or if he gets it too often and just has a general sense of uneasiness, because if you eat all the time, you don't really feel good. Or if there's not a good match between when he needs it and when he gets it, so that even though he gets fed and stays healthy, he's constantly frustrated. Or unpleasant things go along with it, like he gets whacked. You know, like he bites the nipple and his mother whacks him. What kinds of effects would these things have on that child? What kind of ID characteristics could he acquire if things don't go well at that oral stage? By the way, there is a fairly simple maxim for generating at least some expected effects of historical events, which is what these are. And that is that a person takes the world to be as he has found it to be. And if you combine that with a person treats the world as the world he takes it to be, you can then make the transition from history to behavior or attitude. So try it with the case of he doesn't get fed enough. What would the child have found out about the world?
It's not very good.
Right. Is that this world is not one that just has a place for him. It's one where his place is questionable and there may not be one. What kind of attitudes and what kind of behavior would that call for? If you were in that kind of world, what kind of behavior would make sense?
Defensive.
Defensive
how? Guarding, keeping yourself from being injured.
Okay.
Well.
Yeah, you can work it both ways, and I think you've touched the both major lines of approach. The one is to protect against the insecurities and possible dangers and insufficiencies and deprivations. And that is by, say, looking for safe places, hoarding what you have, or, you know, in general, looking for the right niche. What kind of attitude would you have if you did that? Not stingy. We want to save that for next time. Suspicious, yeah. I think suspicious would underlie both the types of approach, because you would be suspicious of the world because you would have found that it doesn't really look after you. And so you would suspect it. You would always be on your guard.
If there's a step towards aggression, and that aggression gets the reinforcement, that could provide for aggression as well. But you have to be more aggressive to get what you need.
Aggressive, or you have to maneuver it. If it doesn't just directly have what you need, then maybe it's something that you got to grab and maneuver.
So manipulate it.
Mm-hmm. Or it's one in which you have to spend all your time looking and finding what you need. Because since it's not forthcoming, you have to just devote your energy to getting it. Now, in place of world, substitute person. Since a lot of the child's interaction is not just with the world at large, but with a person. And conventionally, we speak of mother. So what would his attitude toward his mother be if that were the case?
Suspicious.
Yeah. Would he be cooperative, for example? Would he give her the benefit of the doubt? Would he go along with her on things? You know, we've been talking in adult terms because that's where the logic of it is clearest. Now, imagine an infant that doesn't think clearly this way, but can make crude distinctions of the same general sort. And you wind up with a peculiar kind of language, because we don't have direct knowledge of the thoughts of infants or the distinctions they make, etc. What we have is the ways that the infant's behavior resembles ours. And so if we see an infant who has that kind of experience at a later time fighting over this, we say, well, you see, he learned to mistrust his mother. He didn't acquire this basic trust in other people that he would have acquired if he hadn't had problems here. So what you have here is something on the order of a basically positive social cooperative attitude, very general and undifferentiated source. And that's the difference between having a world in which you fit and having one in which you don't. If there's one in which you fit that provides for you, you cooperate with it, you're friendly toward it, you're positive toward it, you're open to it. If you have a world that doesn't provide what you want, then you're not open to it. You either have to fight it, maneuver it, escape it, or something. You do not cooperate with it, you have to manipulate.
Where does the dependency come from? I'm thinking for the typical moral person, is a very dependent person trying to suck validation from the environment.
Remember I said you might have to spend all your time getting what you want because it's not going to be provided. You might have to spend your time finding it.
So that kind of person, that person might have to cooperate to get what that person wants. It might be a manipulation cooperation, or the face of it would look like that person is cooperating.
Say that again.
Because a real dependent person sometimes has to cooperate, to get some of their dependency needs met.
Think of the difference between cooperation under an achievement description, mm-hmm. which is what you're giving, yeah. and cooperation under a deliberate action description.
Yeah.
That's probably not cooperation, it's manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
Activity-wise, social practice-wise, it's cooperation, but deliberate action, no. Imagine somebody who has this kind of experience and acquires that kind of attitude. And now, let's suppose that it doesn't change. He keeps that attitude, and let's ignore other things that happen. And ask yourself, what would he look like, say, at age 25? All we knew is that was his experience and that he did indeed acquire this suspicious, non-cooperative, manipulative, looking for the world to provide for him. What would you expect them to be like? Here.
He has some real psychopathic tendencies, maybe, because that kind of person would expect to manipulate the environment.
Yeah. Pretty close to the kind of person who looks like very confined.
Well, you could bet that he would be at least somewhat confined in his perspective because he's caught up in a certain kind type of issue that most people here are not. Namely, getting what he needs from that world. One of the things he would have learned, though, is that he can't just have it. And that's why he has to go around looking. also, the terms in which that problem is raised is that he's not self-sufficient. He needs something from the world or else. Because that was the nature of the original circumstance. So if that's what he's like here, see, one of the things you would not expect is a self-sufficient person. Expect a person who is looking to get what he needs from the world, rather than one who has it.
Shouldn't the sources have changed? Is that he no longer gets the same physiological needs?
Yeah, well, that's why we're jumping over here. We want to make this kind of move. If he's acting according to some kind of principle that he acquired early, but he still has it, the way you implement that same principle at age 25 is not via the same customs, practices, and judgments that you do at age 1. It would have to show up in a way that was visibly different, but if it's the same principle, there will be some selectivity here. What's the main thing that transfers?
Mistrust.
Mistrust is one, you can say. But the other is the lack of self-sufficiency. And the mistrust is based on that. Less clearly, you might say disappointment. So if you don't get what you want, and that's a central fact in your life, it would be hard for you not to have some kind of negative reaction, which disappointment is going to be the parent. More than just frustration, it would be disappointment.
Well, there's always the possibility of that disappointment reaching the point at which the person says, well, there's no use anymore. And even trying, I still need it, but I can't get it. So what else?
So I'll just wait for it to happen. Remember, since you're dealing with necessities, you can't just take it or leave it at it. You can't just say, well, I guess I'm just not going to get the necessities of life, so the hell with it. Unless you do. And in that case, you know, if you think along those lines, you think of the apathetic children who never got handled. Well, you could say, well, if we're reading things back into children's heads, and you look at those children, that looks like a good thing to read back in. Then this takes you back over here and say, gee, it's true. There is more happening at that time than just getting fed. There's also the issue of getting handled, of physical contact. And the nature of that contact also has something to do with how you find the world and whether you experience it as something that where you have a place or whether you're out of place. Think of the difference in the experience between a mother who holds that child gently and lovingly versus one who holds it stiffly and resentfully.
I'm not sure why it's the dependency that develops instead of saying receive or.
Because here you're receiving. That's the name of the game, is that you get fed. You're receiving the necessities, you're receiving things that are pleasant.
So, how do you decide whether the later expectation is that you continue to expect that it ought to be there for the. Come to not expect.
Well, remember the principle is you take the world to be as you found it to be. We hypothesize that you found it, that it's not there when you want it. Mm-hmm. It's there enough to keep you going, but it's not routinely there when you want it. That makes it a certain kind of world. It makes it a problematic one rather than a non-problematic one, and that's why we talk about basic trust or something like that.
I don't see where the issue is self-sufficiency.
You have to be fed. It comes from the outside. You can't just satisfy that on your own.
The opposite, where we get the opposite, it is self-sufficient. When you get
to the United States, it's by very nature. No, that's right. In this stage, there's no such issue of being self-sufficient. That's why if you just take the attitude that's here and transport it over here and say he has the same attitude, what you wouldn't expect, one of the things is a self-sufficient person.
Freud thinks that other spirits in the other stages, you might change the attitude.
It's not clear because he doesn't often talk in positive ways like that. What he says most clearly is that if things go wrong here, they're even more likely to go wrong here. And if things go wrong here and here, they're even more likely to go wrong here because this kind of progress is cumulative. But he didn't much discuss whether if things went wrong here, you could really compensate for them back over here. And the general implication seems to be that you couldn't really. Now, that you could cover it up, but not really compensate.
But doesn't that begin to pretty much set the boundaries of personality parameters? So that at age 25, it would be pretty hard for that person to change.
Yeah, well, in this theory, since it is cumulative, you see, the effects of early experience get magnified as you go along. Particularly, defects get magnified as you go along. And that's why for psychoanalytic theory, the first few years are crucial. And why if things go badly there, you may need 5 years of analysis. Because it takes a long time as an adult to undo things that happened easily in your early childhood.
There seems to be a contradiction. You said that in the oral stage, if something goes wrong there, you can end up expecting to be provided for. Is that right?
Looking to be provided for is different from expecting. See, just think of the difference between I stick out my hand and lo and behold, there's something good there versus my having to go through the building asking people, do you have one, do you have one? And then somewhere along the line, I find one. A very different world.
It would seem like a person like who was overfed, who got just about everything they wanted, and either got super handled, would go around expecting the environment to provide, and would be real dependent upon all kinds of things like that. Mm-hmm. So here we do have the non-self-sufficient person who was just drowned.
Okay, that's one of the features of psychoanalytic theory that sometimes gets made fun of, but it has some legitimacy. Namely, that you can go wrong here by not having enough, by deprivation, or by having too much. But, you know, there's all kinds of situations where that's the story. You can either have too much or too little, and both are ways of going wrong. Now let's move from what could go wrong here to what effect would that have over here? See, if we have a list of ways that things could go wrong or what effects that would have, we're talking about mistrust, disappointment, lack of cooperation. And then look at this one and say, well, what goes on here and why and how would this be jeopardized depending on how things went wrong here? Yeah, what goes on is toilet training, and what does that involve?
Learning to wait.
What?
Learning to wait.
That's part of it.
So.
Something on that order. What you have to do is you learn the right time, the right place, the right way. And so, I might say that's the issue. Now contrast over here. Say, what's the issue here? The issue here is not doing it right, it's getting it. Here, the issue is doing it right. Now, what's involved in learning this? What does it take for the child to have the parents lay this on them and cooperate and learn?
Make the same judgments the parents make as to what is the right time, place, and moment.
That's what would be the case if he succeeds, but what does it take antecedently for him to succeed?
A certain kind of trust, a certain kind of going with the doubt, you know.
Some kind of positive attitude, anyway.
Yeah.
Because when somebody starts laying it on you to do it differently from what you've been doing, why would you cooperate with them? Well, either they're making it so unpleasant for you that you have no other choice, or you've got a positive investment in that person, and that's enough to make you willing. But notice that here, unlike the oral stage, you have some kind of resistance, because the child is already doing it in a certain way, and he's being bugged to change the way he does it. So the requirement here is a change in what he's already doing, and so he has a kind of resistance that he doesn't have up here. He doesn't already have a way of feeding, and he doesn't have to change his ways in order to feed. But here, all of a sudden, he's been doing it in a way that is perfectly okay because nothing happens, and then it starts getting laid on him to do it differently.
Is this still part of the mechanism?
No, we're doing this descriptively first and then translate back into Freud. Okay. Let me give you an example of the translation. I just said if you have enough of a positive attitude toward that person, it's worth your while to cooperate with them. Now, instead of that, think of this object as drawing energy from several sources, including, importantly, the oral source. This has been a gratifying object back then, therefore, you got a lot of energy from that source affected here. Comes times when this source is activated that still has a lot of energy affected. If it has enough energy, it'll be the one that comes to mind, and then you act in terms of it. And if you're going to deal effectively with it, here you go. In contrast, suppose that this has not been a satisfying object, will not be what comes to mind, or not as accurately, and you'll have a child who, in effect, ignores the actual mother, because the internal representation that it has at this time isn't that close to the actual mother. So he will, in effect, ignore her and go his own way and run into trouble here. So the degree of positive relationship in these terms comes out the amount of energy connected to the object. Well, here we're come back to descriptively. See, if certain things go wrong here, how can they have a bad effect further? Because the main thrust of psychoanalytic theory is both ways, that things can go wrong, and if they do, that's bad. But perhaps even more importantly, if they go wrong early, they're more likely to go wrong later.
Although I think observationally infants go through this, it's not clear to me how Freud says that a child gets from oral pain in age of child.
He does and he doesn't. One thing, keep in mind, Freud wrote volumes and volumes and volumes. And he did not write it all down neatly in any one place. And when you look at the various places about what he wrote, he says, in effect, there is a transition, and at a later time, this does become more important, and this may be purely maturational, or it may also have social components. How can you argue? But then, you know, why would he be in a position to say anything different? So here we are 50 years later, and we're not in a position to say anything different. So you might say he was just being conservative when he had to, in terms of what he knew. Now, you can say it's clear on the social basis why it changes. Because there are customs that say you start toilet training at 1 year, but you start feeding the first hour. So on from the parental end, there's no problem about why the sequence. It's on the mechanical or physiological end that you have to sort of fudge it and say, well, there's something that does it. But again, if you have faith that someday we're going to discover what it is that does it, then you simply put this as a placeholder, an IOU, and hope that eventually somebody will pay it off for you, which sometimes happens. Okay, how about that? What could go wrong here as a result of something going wrong here? And to take the business of having too much or too little, the thing that we examined was case of deprivation, where you don't get enough. And, Kate pointed out that you can also get too much. You know, you can get thoroughly gratified orally. No frustration, no disappointment, no nothing. And why would that cause trouble over here?
Keep expecting mommy to wipe your ass.
Okay. Think of some... some more legitimate variation on that.
Unable to deal with the tension of being your parents. You know, if you have a way to deal with any kind of tension.
Well, okay, that's one way of putting it. Keep in mind, if this thing is very satisfying, and then he's being asked to change, and the change is itself painful or frustrating, why would he go along with this when he's caught up in getting this kind of satisfaction, the kind he knows and loves so well?
So he might be pretty rebellious.
Yeah, descriptively, you would say he doesn't have frustration tolerance because he's never had to. And that's what it takes here in the course of this learning. And so if he's been too much gratified here, he's not going to be prepared in certain essential ways for this. And so this is going to be extra painful, extra difficult. Therefore, he will have a high chance of failing. Try it the deprivation route. Suppose that he's deprived and suspicious, etc. Why would that make a difference here? Well, you have the cooperation business, but you might also say the mistrust might show up in the notion that there wasn't really any right way. it isn't the kind of world in which things are right.
So it's just sort of arbitrary.
So it's arbitrary. It doesn't, yeah, it doesn't carry conviction. Furthermore, with deprivation, you also have the preoccupation of getting the kind of satisfaction that you've been deprived at. With deprivation, you have the preoccupation with getting the satisfaction that you've been deprived of. So you try that in an adult level, try not eating for 6 days, and then going and taking piano lessons. Yeah, I think your approach would be, to hell with this keyboard, I want something to eat. Well, to hell with all of this stuff, I want my oral needs gratified. So you can say with either too much gratification or too little, you get a preoccupation, although it's of different kinds, but in both cases, a preoccupation with this kind of satisfaction. Therefore, you're missing some of the attention or the attitudes or the energy or something that's required here. And therefore, this task becomes either, well, in some sense or another, more difficult. Therefore, you're less likely to succeed. Now, a preoccupation of the sort that I've mentioned, in which at a later stage in development, your interest, your attention, your concern is back over here, is a fixation. If at a later developmental stage, your attention, concern, and effort, your preoccupation, in effect, concerns issues that appear at an earlier developmental stage, that is a fixation. And since for Freud these were the crucial developmental stages, in psychoanalytic theory you can have an oral, anal, or phallic fixation.
That implies that if Freud were talking about someone preoccupied with nurturance, he'd say he had an oral fixation, someone preoccupied with order and doing things properly and making sure everything happens in the right time and the right place, preoccupied with those, that would be an anal fixation.
No, that's what I was thinking of for next time, is that you can take these and put them column-wise, and for each one of these, list a set of characteristics and behaviors, etc. And I think that probably we should do that next time. So I don't think we have time to even start on that now. So for next time, review the psychosexual stages again, and we'll try to finish up at least that part of the theory and maybe finish up with Freud completely, depending on how much time it takes us to talk a little about unconscious motivation, which is one of the distinctive aspects of Freud. We may finish Freud next time. So Allport, Levine, and the others will be coming up next.
I'm confused in terms of fixation. Is it going back to a state? Well, it's going back to a stage where I think you're preoccupied. But in terms of a stage,
no, it's not going back. It's not going back to a stage.
Okay, you're concerned with those concerns.
Yeah.
That go with that stage.
Yeah.
That can happen both because that was a successful stage and you couldn't handle the next one, or because one before that was successful, but you go to the one that you still have to deal with.
Yeah.
I don't know, sometimes we go over why you go to one or the other.
See, failures, independent failures are possible at each stage. But failures are increased in likelihood if you fail the stage before. So success here doesn't guarantee success later. failure here doesn't really guarantee failure later, but it biases you in that direction.
I just think that case you say you were successful at an oral stage and you're having trouble at an anal stage. Whether you concern yourself with that anal stage, what we're just talking about, or whether you would go back the way you would preoccupy yourself with concerns with the oral stage or try and deal with the
oral stage. Remind me first thing next time. Is what we can talk about regression independently of this, but pegged to instinct rather than this.
I like these.